The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit G. Suggs Insurance. That's GSUGGSinsurance.com. Or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine is a double issue dated September 27/October 4, 2021. As usual, the cover is banded in red with a white inner border. Time in large block print letters is in black today, superimposed upon a greenish, blurry background. Today's issue of Time features 100 most influential people as identified by Time. It says the world's most influential people, actually, on the banner on the top of the cover. It's divided into various categories: pioneers, artists, leadership, icons. That may be the various categories involved. I will not be reading all 100, certainly not today, but there are a few other articles within the issue. Oh, I'll tell you who's on the cover first. Two individuals, Prince Harry and Meghan, the Duke and Duchess of Sussex. She's dressed in white, a compliment against her tan skin. She has long, dark hair, brown eyes. She's smiling at the camera. Harry is next to her with his right hand on her right shoulder. He's dressed in black, fair skin, red hair, blue eyes. Not smiling, but not frowning either. Moving now into the magazine itself, with the first headline being The Brief. It's basically a photo with a very short caption. The photo is that of a hospital room, the hospital bed in the center with white sheets on it, a pillow, a bright yellow cover of some kind, but it's partially folded. I'm unable to determine if it's a fabric or plastic. All kinds of contraptions, of course, connected to this high-tech hospital bed. On the wall behind it is a very large computer screen with a keyboard and mouse on a platform below it. All kinds of other cords and outlets I could not even begin to describe. There's a monitor of some kind off to the side, again with lots of cords dangling from it. The bed is not occupied, however. There's a large window in this room and a door that says staff only, which is beyond the bed. But seated, not really seated, crouching in front of the bed on what appears to be a very shiny, hard surface floor, is a medical worker of some type. I don't see any insignia. I'm not even sure if it's male or female. Crouched in blue scrubs with a blue plastic over wrap, some kind of a jacket or smock. Greenish-blue gloves, probably latex or vinyl, booties over the individual's shoes, blue booties to match the blue scrubs and the blue plastic jacket or smock or whatever it's called. The person's wearing a mask, a white mask, also glasses, also a colorful scrub cap. It looks like it's black with maybe red cherries and green leaves on it. Very colorful. And the caption reads, very simply, overcapacity. A hospital nurse in Grants Pass, Oregon, waits for her next COVID-19 patient to be brought from the emergency room September 9. So pretty soon all those outlets will be plugged in and buzzing and humming and whatever else they do. The brief opener, Health, by Alice Park, in desperate need of more hospital beds. There is a sense of deja vu in the U.S. medical community right now, a year and a half after COVID-19 first slammed into the healthcare system and knocked it down like a feather. Hospital beds are filling up, and most alarmingly, space in intensive care units, ICUs, is at a premium. As of September 14, 80% of ICU beds in the country were occupied, 31% of them filled by patients with COVID-19, according to data collected by the Department of Health and Human Services, HHS. In some states, hospitals already have more patients than beds available. In Alabama, for example, 100% of ICU beds are occupied. But Dr. Karen Landers, assistant state health officer at Alabama Department of Public Health, says in an email to Time, the situation is actually worse. The state reports Alabama hospitals are in negative zone in terms of ICU beds, she writes. Alabama hospitals have more ICU patients than ICU beds. The state is one of a number that have had to ask for federal assistance to care for their critical care patients. Unlike in the previous crush on the healthcare system during the first and second COVID-19 waves, one factor frustrating doctors and nurses this time is that what is driving the surge are people who have not been vaccinated against COVID-19. It is no coincidence. The states with the highest ICU bed occupancy are also those with relatively low vaccination coverage. The strain is pushing health administrators into an ethical corner. How to decide which of the extremely limited beds and staff should go to which patient? As emotionally difficult as it is for doctors and nurses to know that a patient's behavior, whether deciding not to get vaccinated or flouting masking and social distancing recommendations, likely increase their chances of getting sick, medical professionals and ethicists agree those factors should not influence rationing decisions. The truth is that we provide care to diabetics who are noncompliant with their dietary advice and medication, and we provide critical care to smokers who develop heart disease, says Kimberly Johnson, Director of Communications and Marketing for St. Mary's Health, a 23-bed community hospital in Cottonwood, Idaho. Not having a vaccination is not a reason to not provide care. Instead, hospitals are turning to creative and sometimes desperate measures to provide the appropriate care for all of their patients. In Idaho, where 90% of ICU beds are full, the governor declared September 7 that parts of the state would now operate under crisis standards of care, which means care decisions are dictated by factors such as scarcity of equipment, beds, and healthcare staff. To free up room for intensive care, some hospitals are converting cafeterias and education rooms into wards for less acute patients and begging neighboring hospitals, sometimes even across state lines, to take overflow patients. We are robbing Peter to pay Paul, says Johnson. We are wheeling and dealing to find beds, asking other hospitals to take our very acute patients if we can take their less acute ones. But what if there are no such valves to reduce the pressure on the critical care system? In those situations, says David Magnus, director of the Center for Biomedical Ethics at Stanford University, long-standing principles of utilitarianism, prioritization, and egalitarianism apply. Different institutions may come up with varying algorithms that balance these concepts in different ways, with some preferring to focus on addressing social and cultural discrimination, while others prioritize the number of years a younger, healthy person may have yet to live over the absolute number of lives saved. These principles have guided medical decision-making on scarce resources, most notably in distributing organs for transplantation for decades. That does not make allocation decisions any easier, and rationing may grow more necessary in the coming weeks and months as COVID-19 continues to spread. Compounding the problem is the growing concern over shortages of healthcare workers, especially after the Biden administration announced September 9 that the 17 million healthcare workers at facilities receiving Medicare and Medicaid funds must be fully vaccinated. Already there are reports of hospital staffers walking away from their jobs rather than getting vaccinated, disrupting, among other things, care in maternity health services. Everybody who talks about this really hopes we never have to do this. Jeffrey Kahn, director of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics, says of rationing health resources, and it doesn't have to happen. If more people are vaccinated, the virus has fewer opportunities to spread. Studies show fully vaccinated people are far less likely than the unvaccinated to develop severe disease that requires ICU or even hospital care. If the numbers of unvaccinated people remain high, however, the reality is the fast-spreading Delta variant will find a way to bury deeper into communities, not just in the U.S., but around the world, and strain healthcare resources even further. From the brief opener, here's a photo. It's enclosed in blue sky, and it's a giant monolithic stone or concrete structure with some kinds of friezes on the front, an arch in the middle, trees on either side as if it were planted in an avenue. And from the top over the first cornice of artwork, there are what look like bed sheets, and they're somehow attached to the structure with blue fabric or wires or some of both, and the interior of the archway is also covered with this blue fabric. The caption reads, "It's a wrap," WRAP. A team of 95 workers cover the Arc de Triomphe in Paris in 270,000 square feet of recyclable fabric September 12 in preparation for a posthumous installation by artists Christo and Jean-Claude. The couple were famous for transforming landscapes and buildings using materials on a massive scale, including wrapping the Berlin Reichstag in 1995 and the Pont Neuf Bridge also in Paris in 1985. The Arc de Triomphe installation will run September 18 to October 3. That description was written by Ciara Nugent, and now one can pick out on the top of this structure tiny-looking people. The bulletin on the same page here, the brief opener, by Alana Abramson. Democrats scramble to deliver on Biden's $3.5 trillion spending package. One of the few bright spots for President Joe Biden during a bruising August was the hope that come September, Congress would pass his $4 trillion agenda. For months, Biden's been haggling with lawmakers to reach a deal on both a sweeping infrastructure package that would improve the country's aging roads and bridges and a $3.5 trillion 10-year spending plan that would create federal paid leave programs, offer universal pre-K, and expand Medicare in the biggest boost to the U.S. social safety net in over half a century. The infrastructure bill has bipartisan support, but Democrats want to pass the $3.5 trillion plan along party lines under a budgetary procedure known as reconciliation. Committees in the House and Senate are currently drafting language for the plan's components. With razor-thin majorities in both chambers, the party can afford few defections, leaving leaders trying to hammer out several key sticking points and deliver a win to Biden. There are likely to be weeks of intense negotiations ahead. The party's progressive wing has been adamant from the start about using the spending plan to improve Americans' access to health care, largely by expanding Medicare, increasing the number of people covered by Medicaid, investing in home care, and lowering drug prices. Moderates, however, would prefer to use funding to strengthen the Affordable Care Act. When senators on the Budget Committee reached an agreement on the $3.5 trillion top line in July, progressives were ecstatic. Some, having now already scaled back their wish lists, say they won't settle for less. But some moderates, including Senators Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema, whose votes Democrats need to pass the plan via reconciliation, think the figure is too high. And while Democrats are nearly unanimous in wanting to pay for the plan by raising taxes on corporations and wealthy Americans, the details thereof, including how much the corporate tax rate will increase, still need to be finalized. Here are some short items from news ticker. Newsom, N-E-W-S-O-M, wins out in California recall election. Governor Gavin Newsom successfully defeated a Republican-led recall effort, estimated to have cost the state nearly $300 million, September 14. Conservative radio talk show host Larry Elder led among Newsom's 46 challengers, but did not find enough support to overtake the powerful Democrat. Poll, P-O-L-L, Climate Impacts Gen Z Plans for Kids. 4 in 10 Generation Z youth are hesitant about having children because of the climate crisis, according to a new survey of 10,000 people around the world, ages 16 to 25. More than half said they were very or extremely worried about climate change and said governments are not doing enough. Probe false Capitol cops January 6 actions. Amid an ongoing internal investigation of the January 6 riots at the U.S. Capitol, the U.S. Capitol Police said September 11, 6 cases of wrongdoing by officers have been identified and disciplinary actions recommended. The behavior included failure to comply with directives and conduct unbecoming. More brief news here. 3 more news ticker short items. Haiti PM fires top official over Moïse claims. Amid ongoing investigations into the assassination of President Jovenel Moïse, who was killed July 7, Haiti's Prime Minister Ariel Henry ousted Chief Public Prosecutor Bedford Claude September 14. Claude had been pushing to charge Henry as a suspect in Moïse's killing. DOJ sues Texas over abortion ban. The U.S. Department of Justice sued Texas September 9, arguing its new ban on abortion as early as 6 weeks before many people know they're pregnant is unconstitutional. September 14, the DOJ also filed an emergency request to halt the law's enforcement until its suit is resolved. Climate referendum in Norway vote. Norway's September 13 elections, which had centered largely on how the country is to deal with its large oil industry in the climate change era, resulted in victory for the center-left Labour Party. Labour had backed a slow phase-out of the oil sector, but smaller parties supporting a speedier shutdown may hold some power in coalition talks. Sports. Golden rules. four short items here by Madeline Carlyle. Ethiopian athlete Derara Huarisa, 24, was disqualified after winning the Vienna Marathon September 12 because the soles of his shoes were 1 centimeter thicker than the race's rules allowed. Here, other elite athletes penalized for unusual reasons. Seeing double. Puerto Rican twins Madeline and Margaret De Jesus were pulled from the 1984 Olympics when officials discovered Madeline had posed as her sister. In the 4x400-meter relay event, after Margaret was injured. Win some, lose some. 8 badminton players were disqualified during the 2012 Olympics after appearing to try to lose their matches on purpose in order to secure an easier pairing during the next round. High hopes. American track and field star Sha'Carri Richardson was disqualified from the 2020 Olympics after testing positive for tetrahydrocannabinol, THC, which she said she smoked in a state where marijuana is legal. I'm going to abridge the next article, but I will read to you a couple of paragraphs. Eben Shapiro writes, "What is the Met Museum to do with its Sackler wing?" That's S-A-C-K-L-E-R. In the wake of a recent bankruptcy court settlement, the Metropolitan Museum of Art, the nation's biggest art museum, will revisit its decision to keep the Sackler name on some of its most high-profile galleries. September 1, Purdue Pharma LP, the maker of the highly addictive painkiller OxyContin, was granted court approval for a restructuring plan that includes roughly $4.5 billion in settlement payments from members of the Sackler family who own the company. Purdue had filed for bankruptcy protection in 2019 after being hit with thousands of lawsuits from states, towns, and others over its role in fueling the deadly opioid epidemic. With the recent action of the court, one can expect that all institutions, including ours, will be having a conversation about how to proceed, the museum's president and CEO, Daniel Weiss, told Time. What we're trying to do is create a process around which fairness will out, Weiss said in a September 8 interview. It's not for us to make a judgment about the responsibility or culpability of the Sacklers with information that's incomplete, but information in both the bankruptcy proceedings and a new book on the family from journalist Patrick Radden Keefe will have a bearing on his recommendation to the board regarding the fate of the Sackler name, he'd added. Weiss declined to share what his recommendation to the board would be, saying, "One of my leadership principles is shared governance. And that means we have the right forum in the right room to have candid conversations about what's best for the institution. What I've done is I've immersed myself substantively in the case. I have spent an enormous amount of time being informed so that my recommendations to the board will be based on a deep understanding about this case, and I have strong views." The final authority to rename or not to rename resides with the Mets board. "There is no way for me, ex cathedra, to remove the name," Weiss explained. "And if I do not bring a really thoughtful, substantive case to the board, then they're not going to know how to make that decision." Milestones. Here's a photograph of a young woman on a blue surface, bordered in white and green. She's hitting a tennis ball. She's dressed in red and blue and yellow with white tennis shoes. The caption reads, "Emma Raducanu, R-A-D-U-C-A-N-U, returns a shot during the women's singles final of the U.S. Open, September 11 in New York City." Sean Gregory writes, "Serving notice at the U.S. Open. surveying for Match Point in what could be the most unlikely Grand Slam victory in tennis history at the U.S. Open September 11. Emma Raducanu fired a 108-mile-per-hour ace wide past Leila Fernandez before falling to the ground, placing her hands over her eyes. She lay flat on her back for a few seconds in disbelief. Raducanu, 18, who had bested Fernandez, 19, in straight sets, is the first qualifier ever to win a major championship and also the first British woman to win a Grand Slam event in over 40 years. Raducanu's game is mature beyond her years, despite having to win 3 matches just to qualify for the tournament's main draw and 7 more to raise its trophy. She never lost her grace and power along the way. She neglected to drop a single set en route to the title, a streak of 20, unlikely to be duplicated. Women's tennis could now be set for a transition, with Raducanu and Fernandez from Canada primed to carry the sport into the next decade. Serena Williams will remain the game's biggest draw, but she's nearing the end of her career. She missed the U.S. Open because of a torn hamstring and last won a Grand Slam in 2017. Naomi Osaka won 4 Grand Slam titles in her short career, but after a season in which she's been open with her mental health struggles, her future appears somewhat uncertain. After one improbable run, heaping expectations on Raducanu to carry tennis forward may be unfair, but she seems preternaturally equipped for the challenge. I don't feel any pressure, she says. I'm just having a free swing at anything that comes my way. That's how I faced every match here in the States, and it got me this trophy, so I don't think I should change anything. And the next column is by Andrew R. Chow, died. Norm MacDonald, a delivery guy. Norm MacDonald was responsible for some of the worst punchlines in Hollywood history. There are times when Bob has something on his mind when he wears a hat, the comedian proclaimed stone-faced at Comedy Central's roast of Bob Saget in 2008. But it was his setups, delivery, and commitment to his jokes that made MacDonald, who died of cancer at 61, September 14, one of the unique and irreplaceable voices in modern comedy. MacDonald first broke out on Saturday Night Live in the 90s, commandeering the Weekend Update desk with a lacerating deadpan. He later found success in stand-up specials and late-night appearances, inducing unbridled fits of laughter in his most frequent sparring partner, Conan O'Brien. MacDonald thrived on the edge of convention and in moments of discomfort. He was a man of his time and made plenty of racialized and gender-based jokes that would be considered offensive by today's standards. But his provocations were usually more conceptual. MacDonald thumbed his nose at the art form of the joke itself. There's a very small thumbnail sketch here of a smiling Norm MacDonald. More milestones, beginning with 3 in the died column. Michael K. Williams, the actor best known for his roles on HBO's The Wire and Boardwalk Empire, at 54, September 6. Carl Bean, B-E-A-N, the LGBTQ church leader, HIV/AIDS activist, and performer of the disco classic I Was Born This Way, at 77, September 7. Abimael Guzman, the founder of Peru's Shining Path, a Maoist rebel group notorious for using terror, at 86, September 11. Quarantined, Russian President Vladimir Putin, September 14, after several COVID-19 cases were confirmed among his inner circle, opened the trial of former Theranos, that's Theranos, founder and CEO, Elizabeth Holmes, on 12 felony charges of wire fraud and conspiracy to commit wire fraud in San Jose, California, September 8. Granted French citizenship to roughly 12,000 immigrant workers on the pandemic's front lines in a special naturalization ceremony, September 9. decriminalized access to abortion for women across Mexico by a Supreme Court ruling September 7, raised $15 million by the bioscience venture Colossal, which aims to use genetic engineering and CRISPR, that's C-R-I-S-P-R, in caps, technology to resurrect woolly mammoths, the company announced September 13. There's a two-page photograph. It's dark. There are two men dressed in dark clothing from head to foot, standing in a dark room with dark draperies on all sides. There's a light bulb in the ceiling, but it's not turned on. I'll read the caption. The photograph is by Philippe Dana, AP. Reclaiming control, Taliban fighters walk inside an empty cell at Pul-e-Charkhi prison in Kabul, September 13. After the Taliban's takeover of the capital, August 15, the prison's former guards fled. Pul-e-Charkhi, which has a long history of abuse, torture, and overcrowding under prior regimes, is the country's largest prison and had been previously the Afghan government's primary Taliban detention site. Today, Taliban forces, some of whom had been formerly incarcerated there themselves, have freed their peers and are now serving as makeshift wardens. Moving now into Times 100 People of Influence, I think it's called. Starting with Dolly Parton, living legend. There sure is a black and white photo here of Dolly standing apparently at her dressing room table. It looks like a bathroom counter with cabinets underneath and a flat hard surface on top, and there are spray cans and Kleenex boxes and mirrors. It's profile of Dolly, so her long straight blonde hair is falling over her shoulders onto kind of a shiny looking two-toned jumpsuit, and her eyes and the rest of her face are already made up for performance. She's looking into the mirror, apparently. Living Legend by Miley Cyrus. Have you ever met anyone who does not love Dolly Parton? I never have. Dolly's not only my idol because of her incomparable career, she's also my role model because of her steadfast morals and values. At her core, she's the definition of a humanitarian. She's also the world's most impeccably purposeful walking contradiction, having developed her iconic look after being inspired by the town tramp. Now she's known as a saintly, even godlike figure. I remember when she came in to do a table read for Hannah Montana in all her bedazzled glory. Her smell, the way her nails tapped the table, the sound it made when she flipped the pages of the script, I could see that she fascinated other people too. A living fantasy was in front of all of us. But though she created an identity that she downplays as being built on wigs, lots of gingham and silicone, the foundation for this empire is actually her honesty, truth, and her faith. People look to Dolly for guidance, and she knows that. She wears that responsibility with the same grace and pride. She rocks a two-piece nudie suit. She recognizes how impactful her choices will be as one of the most iconic and powerful voices in country music, and she leaves no one behind. Dolly has diligently celebrated the queer community, and her imagination library provides millions of books for kids. The only thing Dolly loves more than glitter is children. Last year, she donated $1 million to COVID-19 vaccine research, which helped in critical early stages. There's a multitude of reasons why vaccination is important to protect other people, but it's also to get the show back on the road and bring live music to our audiences again. There's a theory, you should not meet your heroes, but I wish everyone had the chance to meet Dolly Parton, because she's even better than your sparkliest dreams. She may be my fairy godmother, but I think she's that to everyone else, too. I'm happy to share her with the world. Miley Cyrus wrote this little piece, and she's a Grammy-nominated musical artist. Flipping the page now to a photo of a young woman in a chartreuse tennis outfit. The skirt, the tan, legs, arms, and shoulders, and face. She's wearing a black visor. She's holding a silvery metal tennis racket aloft. Naomi Osaka. Modeling Change by Russell Wilson. Wilson's an NFL player for Seattle Seahawks. Naomi Osaka's humility and dedication to others has been spectacular to watch. It's incredibly meaningful. She's been able to talk honestly about struggling with her mental health and share with us her vulnerability. She's been able to say to the world, "Hey, listen, I'm going through something. Here's my truth." In doing that, she's serving others, just as she has before. After the death of George Floyd in May 2020, Naomi participated in protests in Minneapolis. During last year's U.S. Open, which she ultimately won, Naomi wore masks honoring seven black Americans killed in recent years, including Trayvon Martin and Breonna Taylor. She shows you can be among the best in the world at what you do and still fight for justice and be open about the challenges you face. We all have the capacity to make a difference, but sometimes someone's sphere of influence is so great they can change a culture, change a society, change a whole world. Naomi Osaka has the power to do that. Next, Billie Eilish, E-I-L-I-S-H, Powerful Voice by Megan Thee Stallion. Megan Thee Stallion is a Grammy-winning musical artist. Billie Eilish, E-I-L-I-S-H, is a unique soul with a voice, style, and attitude all unapologetically her own. I first met Billie at the Grammys this year. She had already achieved worldwide stardom, which might make some people have airs about them, but not Billie. She was so real and laid back, even though her personality is so big. She's a rare spirit who speaks from her heart with no pretenses. I knew I had found a kindred spirit that night, one who is strong but still learning and still growing, a woman who stands up for herself and advocates for women everywhere. Sunisa, S-U-N-I-S-A, Lee, Achieving Excellence by Nastia Liukin, and Liukin is a 5-time Olympic medalist. Under the bright lights of sport's biggest arena, Sunisa Lee's Olympic performance not only cements her legacy, but also symbolizes strength and fuels inspiration around the world. Facing unprecedented headwinds during a pandemic, as well as personal adversity and the weight of a nation's expectations, Suni was placed in a unique position to display the unstoppable force that she is. Fiery but kind, dedicated but abundant with youthful joy, and fiercely talented. While her gold medal win in this year's all-around competition accomplishes a lifelong ambition, her journey as an individual outside of gymnastics is just beginning. As the first Hmong American Olympian, Suni has an impact that extends far beyond any border or sport. It signifies representation. This milestone has and will continue to inspire the Hmong community, but it also sends a simple yet powerful message to underrepresented people everywhere. Dream big, because anything is possible. There's a photo of Sunisa Lee here doing one of her, probably vaults. The background's blurry, like there's a big audience, lots of blues and whites and blacks and bright spotlights to her back. She's wearing red, white, and blue. Her arms and her legs are far outstretched and extended, and the legs are extended in what one would perceive to be the splits. She's looking serious. She's looking down at whatever that surface below her holds. Franz Timmermans. Taking Ambitious Steps by Christiana Figueres. Figueres is co-founder of Global Optimism and a former executive secretary of UN Framework Convention on Climate Change. The latest Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report leaves no doubt about the fact that we stand on the edge of a precipice beyond which human prosperity on this planet can no longer be taken for granted. Unless we radically change our ways, we severely endanger our social, political, and economic future. Frans Timmermans, Executive Vice President of the European Commission, understands the risk we face and has stepped up. He has presented the Fit for 55 program in the EU, an ambitious package of regulatory instruments to cut EU greenhouse gas emissions by 55% by 2030, an important milestone toward the goal of reaching carbon neutrality by 2050. The long-term gain of the policies is clear and compelling, though the short-term implementation is much more of a challenge. Timmermans is committed to ensuring justice in the transition. He walks where few have ventured forth, but where all nations must follow. Aurora James. Moving Fashion Forward by Edward Enninful. And Enninful is editor-in-chief of British Vogue and European editorial director of Vogue. When I think of the designer Aurora James, founder of Brother Vellis, V-E-L-L-I-E-S, I see a woman who has not only shifted the culture and fashion, but also rethought its economic power structures. These past 2 years have been a time of great upheaval for our industry and have brought immense pain for the black community. Yet James, a gifted designer and passionate activist, has risen up to take major retailers to task with her 15% pledge initiative, asking them to finally reflect the makeup of the U.S. population by stocking products from a proportionate number of black-owned businesses on their shelves. It's the sort of tangible change that can have a real impact on society. Macy's, Sephora, and Bloomingdale's count among the companies that have already signed on. As someone who started his career in fashion, first as a model, then a stylist, in London during the late 80s, I know what it takes to make it as a black person in this industry, that often you have to work 10 times as hard. James is not only working for herself. Her tenacity, vision, and strength are an inspiration. You need to be able to see the whole picture to make a real difference, and James does exactly that. Adi Uttarini, Confronting Disease by Melinda French Gates. French Gates is the co-chair of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and founder of Pivotal Ventures. Adi, A-D-I, Uttarini, U-T-A-R-I-N-I. A few years ago, on a trip to Indonesia, I visited a family near Adi Uttarini's lab in Yogyakarta. I wanted to hear how she managed to convince them to let her release swarms of mosquitoes around their neighborhood. Their obvious pride in being part of her work was a testament to the trust Uttarini has earned from her community and to the urgency millions around the world feel in the fight against dengue fever. It is a triumph of global progress that most infectious disease rates have trended downward year over year. Dengue fever, however, that's D-E-N-G-U-E, space fever, is a stubborn exception. The mosquito-borne illness affects almost 400 million people annually and has been described by the WHO as one of the 10 greatest threats to the world's health. Uttarini is working with an international team of researchers from the World Mosquito Program to curb this threat by inoculating mosquitoes with Wolbachia, a bacteria that's harmless to humans but blocks mosquitoes from transmitting dengue with their bite. A groundbreaking study she helped lead was the first to prove this technique successfully drives down disease rates in community settings. Today, most everyone in Yogyakarta knows someone who has had dengue. Uttarini herself has survived it twice. Dengue, however, may not survive her. Fatih Birol, F-A-T-I-H-B-I-R-O-L, Calculating the Path to Net Zero by John Kerry. Kerry, K-E-R-R-Y, is the U.S. Special Presidential Envoy for Climate. In a world where facts are assaulted, Fatih Birol combines the best of high-tech data, optimistic know-how, and old-school rhetorical finesse. A trusted counselor to world leaders, he is an objective authority on what it will take to slash carbon emissions and save our planet. His data-driven approach is like Moneyball for the clean energy revolution. Birol has transformed the International Energy Agency from a body mostly monitoring oil markets into a leading advisor to the world's major economies across the full suite of energy technologies. Building on over 10 years of analysis, this year, his IEA released its first comprehensive roadmap for reaching global net zero emissions by 2050 and minimizing the risk of catastrophic climate impacts. Countries including India, China, Indonesia, and Colombia have all asked him to chart roadmaps to speed climate action and reach net zero emissions. When we get there, and if we get there in time, trust that Faith Birol guided the course to turn words into reality. Esther Zainabombo and Yai Tinsarmong, Contributing to a Movement, by Mimi I. I's author of Mandalay, Recipes and Tales from a Burmese Kitchen, and host of the food and culture podcast, the MSG Pod. Three fingers aloft, faces aglow, clad in their bright red shirts, a nod to the Karen, K-A-R-E-N, ethnic minority, Esther Zay Na Bambo, that's C-E space N-A-W space B-A-M-B-O, who is Kachin, K-A-C-H-I-N, and E-I, E-I space Tinzar, T-H-I-N-Z-A-R, Mong, M-A-U-N-G, who is Shani, S-H-A-N hyphen N-I, were a vision of strength, honor, and justified anger as they led people on the very first anti-military protest in Yangon, 5 days after the February 1 coup that violently robbed Myanmar of its freedom. The fierceness of Myanmar's women has long been suppressed by its military, so this brave new generation sent a surge of pride through us all. Through their work, both activists have broken new ground. Esther's a leader of the Kachin Peace Network and was one of the few people in the past who were courageous enough to speak up for the Rohingya. Ai Tinzar, also a longtime activist on ethnic minority rights, has been named Myanmar's youngest ever deputy minister in the National Unity Government, an exiled group formed by members of parliament ousted in the coup. It's thanks to these women and others like them that we finally have hope for the future of Myanmar. Olympia Coral Melo Cruz, by Amanda Nguyen. Nguyen's CEO and founder of RISE, a civil rights nonprofit that advocates for survivors of sexual violence. Olympia Coral Melo Cruz, a women's rights activist from the Mexican city of Puebla, is a survivor of revenge porn, sexual content that's shared without the consent of those featured within it. She turned her experience into action, and in April 2021, Mexico passed Olympia's Law, federally prohibiting the sharing of such content without the subject's permission. Most U.S. states have passed similar measures, and consequences for distributing revenge porn vary in some places, from misdemeanor offenses to felonies. But anti-revenge porn legislation has yet to pass on the federal level. Melo Cruz and I are kindred spirits, and I hope she inspires people around the world to not only take up this cause, but also speak up for themselves. It can be difficult to be a survivor, speaking up about something so personal. But Melo Cruz's impact will not only be meaningful right now, it will be remembered in history. And history's on her side. She has changed the world. That is what she symbolizes. Dorothea Red Eye, A More Inclusive Vision by Terry Rentke. Rentke's a German member of the European Parliament and co-president of the Parliament's LGBTI intergroup. Dorothea is spelled D-O-R-O-T-T-Y-A. Red Eye, R-E-D-A-I. A princess falling in love with another princess and riding into the sunset together. How much would a story like that have meant to me when I was a little girl? How much pain and shame could it have prevented? The LGBTI plus community in Hungary is one of the most popular targets for Prime Minister Viktor Orban's hate crusades. Standing up to this takes a lot of courage. It means enduring smear campaigns in an already hostile societal environment of restricted press freedoms and attacks on the rule of law and fundamental rights. This hostility is amplified by a bombardment of rhetoric that everybody who is different is a threat to the country. Dorothea Red Eye is a symbol of the courage needed in such an environment. In collaboration with fellow members of the Labrys Lesbian Association and book editor Bolzizar Naji, the academic and activist spearheaded the development of the children's book, A Fairy Tale for Everyone, which incorporates LGBTI plus characters into reimaginings of traditional fairy tales. This work shows so beautifully how colorful life is. It makes young people believe that no matter who you are, there's a fairy tale waiting for you that is your life. When publishing stories with lesbian, gay, and non-binary characters becomes a reason to adopt laws restricting freedom of expression, it's clear democracy's in grave danger, as it is in Hungary. But there is hope, and with people like Dorothea Red Eye and her colleagues at the forefront of the struggle for equality, we can continue to believe in a happy ending. Ron Klain, K-L-A-I-N, Power Player, by Hillary Rodham Clinton. Clinton, a Democrat, is a former U.S. Senator and Secretary of State and the first woman to be a presidential nominee of a major party. Sometimes the most qualified person gets the job. The White House chief of staff must be a policy wonk, legislative mastermind, political guru, management whiz, and trusted presidential advisor all rolled into one. It's hard to imagine anyone better suited for this impossible position than Ron Klain. It is not just that he served as chief to two vice presidents, including Joe Biden, or that his success containing Ebola prepared him to tackle COVID-19, or that his deep ties and deft touch on Capitol Hill are helping advance an ambitious economic equity and climate agenda. It is that Ron has one of the coolest heads and quickest minds in politics. That's why I was so grateful to have him by my side as a candidate for president, and why America is fortunate to have him in this critical job at this critical moment. Stacey Abrams, Advocating for Voters, by Harry Belafonte, who's an activist and Grammy, Emmy, Tony-winning musical artist. The inordinate strength revealed by black people in America in their capacity to survive the harsh political journey they experience in this country is in large part due to the fortitude of black women. The power to exercise this resistance is in no small part due to leaders like Stacey Abrams. Not just black women, but all people have been the beneficiaries of this gift of survival in the name of truth and solidarity. Stacy embodies the enormousness of this gift. Alongside a diverse coalition of organizers and volunteers, she spent years working to transform and empower the Georgia electorate. That work resulted in record voter turnout in recent elections. Thank you, Stacy, for all that you have done. Mamata Banerjee, Ascendant Politician by Barca Dutt. Dutt's an Indian television journalist and author. Mamata Banerjee in her signature white sari paired with rubber flip-flops has become the face of fierceness in Indian politics. May 2, she stood like a fortress against the expansionist ambition of Narendra Modi, a seemingly invincible prime minister, when she retained her role of chief minister of West Bengal in the state's assembly elections, despite the money and men of the ruling Bharatiya Janata Party. Unlike many other women in Indian politics, Mamata has never been framed as someone's wife, mother, daughter, or partner. She rose from abject poverty, working once as a stenographer and a milk booth vendor to support her family. Of Banerjee, it's said she does not lead her party, the Trinamool Congress. She is the party. The street fighter spirit and self-made life in a patriarchal culture set her apart. If any coalition of forces were to come together to counter Modi nationally, Mamata is certainly pivotal. We've run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine's available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.